Good morning, folks. Welcome to Inside CP, our podcast, where we talk about a whole bunch of things. Today, we're going to be doing a live episode on Inside CP. You can hear cars going by. A little windy out here today. But glad to have you here. This is David. It's Wednesday morning, May 6th. We are a little less than 6 months out from the election. And I have the privilege today of talking to one of our colleagues, Bert Greenwood, who is someone who works with me on our Federal Election Commission monthly report. We file a monthly report with the FEC. She's also been one of our leads for our Florida team. She's been administrative support for us and also just all around passionate and fired up about civic engagement. Bert Greenwood is just an amazing member of our team. Hey, Bert, are you there?
Hey, David, I am. Good morning.
Good morning, Bert. I know that you and I will be awake early. So I'm like, this is perfect for us to do our podcast.
That is true. We've had early morning conversations generally about matters financial, but sometimes just, you know, things esoteric, such as the craziness going on in Florida right now in the courts as we speak.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I appreciate you getting on this podcast to do this episode with me. This is our weekly series. I try to do one a week called Inside CP, where I interview someone who's part of our organization, either in a formal leadership role, like you are, or in a volunteer leadership role, which you also are. And I ask them a little bit about themselves and learn about them. And then we also spend some time talking about the work they do for CP. So you're good with both of those?
I am good with both of those.
Thanks. And full disclosure to everybody, Bert had about 15 minutes to know that we were going to do this, but that's just what makes her awesome. I knew I was going to go for a walk because I have to get up and do a couple Zoom calls early today. So once when I was up and going, and I'm like, I bet Bert is up. And I've been wanting to talk to you, so I'm like, this is perfect timing, and appreciate you coming on.
Of course, it's an honor. Thanks for asking.
Oh, sure. It's a windy day, as I've already mentioned to people, so there's definitely some noise. Nothing unusual about that with my podcast. But I did put on a hat this morning so that I could maybe block out a little bit of that wind. So I want to start. I want to go for about maybe 20-30 minutes here about just learning about you. And there's one of the things that I have loved about doing these interviews is I learned so many things about colleagues, people I care about a great deal, but you know, we haven't ever, or mostly haven't, sat down and had long discussions or even kind of like short discussions, but with some real kind of personal depth to them. So let me just start with asking you, let's think about the period of time before you were done with high school. So the first 18 years of your life, or roughly around then, what might have been one or two, or what was one or two really important things in your life? It could have been a person, it could have been an experience, it could have been something you learned or figured out. What would be one or two shaping experiences for you, shaping things for you?
Oh, wow. Well, for me, I'd say that the singular most shaping experience for me, when I was 7 years old, I was in a catastrophic bicycle accident, which resulted in those days of a lot of internal bleeding. And long story short, I was hospitalized for a long period of time and then bedridden, as they used to call it, for an even longer period of time, which meant, you know, I didn't have a normal 7-year-old, 8-year-old experience. And then there were some rather significant health issues that came from that. So it extended sort of my, you know, lack of robust health kind of extended all the way through middle school. So that said, what happened then, sort of the second important aspect was I had a second grade teacher by the name of Mrs. Mitchell, and she was much feared because back in those days, corporal punishment was, you know, I wouldn't say it's common in elementary school, but it wasn't unheard of. And so she had a reputation of kind of being a tough nut. And when I got out of the hospital and was bedridden at home, she just took it upon herself to visit me every week with library books. Now I'm in the second grade, with library books and worksheets to keep me occupied. And she would sit at my bedside and just spend time with me. My mom was quite unprepared for really taking care of me. The enormous stress and worry and concern just kind of rippled through our family in some really big ways. But Mrs. Mitchell was just always there, and she introduced me to reading as a way of getting out of my bed. And that's kind of how she told me what reading could be for me. So I became this voracious reader, and she did not bring me like age appropriate books. Not that they were inappropriate, but they were much older. She thought I needed to be, you know, like encouraged. And so she brought me primarily biographies and autobiographies. So here I am, this little, you know, kid, and I'm reading about, you know, two of my favorite books that I remember in elementary school were Joan of Arc and Mary, Queen of Scots. And so I became this kid who loved reading. Reading was my escape. My vocabulary grew exponentially. When I finally went back to school, they decided that they would test me and then they would accelerate me through grades, right? So back in the day, they used to call it skipping grades.
Yeah.
So if you can imagine, I'm this kid and I haven't had any socialization really to speak of with peers. Now they skip me a grade. They drop me in with kids who are older than me, more emotionally mature than me, you know, more, just more everything than me. And it just changed my life. It changed my group of friends, because the kids that I would have been, you know, my contemporaries, I'm ahead of them. We have different recess, we have different lunch, you know, all of that. And so I just became a person who, or a kid, who just really lived in books and learning, and I practiced piano 4 hours a day because I couldn't do anything else. So I think that's the most significant. If I look at my life, it's sort of like COVID-19. There's the before and there's the after. And it also kind of changed the kid I was, which, if anybody's had children or they themselves have had sort of catastrophic events, be it death or grief or loss or illness, it's often found that there's a profound sort of psychological change. And so there really is kind of a before kid and an after kid. So my after kid was just this very serious sort of, I was the kid when people always said, oh, it'll be fine, everything will be fine. There was always a voice in the back of my head that said, well, not exactly, because everything hadn't been fine. So that was the first thing. But, you know, I grew and I thrived, and I primarily thrived because of teachers. And the next most significant thing that happened in my life was, in the eighth grade, I met a woman named Mary Lindetta. She was my eighth grade drama teacher. She just recently passed at the age of 97, and she's been my best friend since I was 13. She absolutely changed the course of my life in so many ways. I can't even count them. She was my role model. She was the person who taught me how to be a mother, how to be a grandmother, how to be a friend and an activist. She was the first, she's the first person I ever door knocked with.
Wow. There's so much. We could not move any further and just talk about those pieces in your life, and I would love so much about you. But thank you for just sharing those elements. And thank you. So when you, Did you go to college?
Yeah, interestingly, I went to college. I started college when I was 46 years old, and I graduated at 51.
Okay, so you didn't go to college at what we would call a traditional college age, and you went through, and I'm actually, even though I've been a professor for a number of years, I'm really big on the perspective that not everybody either A, needs to go to college, or B, needs to go to college in any kind of traditional framework. Like, there are different paths in life, and people need to figure them out and find those, and that there's many ways towards happiness and fulfillment. So what were two things that were major between 18 and 41? You said 41 is when you went to college?
Or 46.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, okay. I'm a little nervous to ask you this question, but so what were one or two big things in that 18 to 46 year old age that clearly defined you in that period of time?
Oh, well, so probably the first thing that defined me, because it became my career path for over 30 years, was I didn't go to college because in my family, which had been now shattered by divorce, my mom had to go to work. Neither of my parents graduated from high school. So I wouldn't say that education was necessarily something, at least formal education around college was something that was necessarily, you know, something that we sat around and talked about. I am always so envious when I hear of parents who, or, you know, people who over the dinner table, they talked with their parents about, like, where are you going to go to college? And, you know, what do you want to study? Those were not the conversations we had. Our conversations were generally, you need to get a job. You need to then participate in supporting our family. I had a sibling, an older brother, who did go to college right after high school, followed the more traditional plan, because he was seen in my family as sort of being a genius. So my role, being 5 years younger, was get a job, a good job, a steady job, which in my mom's view was either work for the post office, work for civil service, or work for the phone company.
At the age of
17, I applied to what was then called Pacific Telephone. I couldn't pass the typing test, so I became a long distance operator, and that started my career that completely reshaped my life over the course of 3 decades. And then I'd say the second thing that happened was there was a period of time where I lived in Mexico, and almost 5 years, and that was extremely life forming and life changing.
Wow. So for Pacific Telephone Company, you spent, how long did you work there? Almost 30 years?
Right. I took early retirement, actually, right at my 30th year.
Okay. And I know from other conversations that we've had that there, you moved into eventually over time into some significant leadership positions with a lot of people who look to you as their supervisor and leader. So what coming out of those, or based upon those many years in that organization and in undoubtedly different positions and sets of responsibilities over time, what were kind of a couple characteristics that you came out of there after all that, or just through life as well, knowing, like, this is what good leadership looks like, that good leadership does, or good leadership is, like X. Well, how would you finish either of those sentences in terms of primary characteristics? Good leadership does, or good leadership is?
I think there was a kind of an interesting intersection for me. So my faith intersected with my career. And then I had some tremendous role models. And so we'll go back to a name I already used, Mary Lindetta. Mary Lindetta was a woman of extreme faith. She was raised by a mother and a father who were both ministers in the Church of Christ. And her mom played, as most women would back in the day, sort of the, you know, wife of the minister role, but was significant in the church. And so I was, you know, so impacted by this woman of faith. And they believed, and she believed, and in sort of this servant leader mentality, right? Like, leaders are servants, and servants are serving is not a subservient way to be. Uh-huh. Like, it is a, sure, it is a really, it is something to aspire to be of, okay, service is to aspire to the highest level. And then during my career, because I started as an operator, and the phone company at that time was a tremendous place to work because we had the ability to test into new positions. So as you gained more skills or you learned more, you could become something different. And so I became a person who chased positions that paid a lot of money, because I'm now a single mom and I have children to raise. And I found another mentor by the name of Rosaline Darrington, who was a Scottish woman and who really believed that smart people and capable people who worked really hard could move into leadership roles even if they didn't fit the profile. And at that time, the really high paying jobs were held primarily by white males, okay, with a lot of them coming out of the military. Mm. Because after Korea and after Vietnam, the phone company in general really went after, you know, officers. They wanted to bring officers in as executives because they demonstrated the sort of quasi-typical leadership roles. So there was kind of an intersection for me. And using my faith or slash my spiritual beliefs in leadership turned out to be something that was quite successful for me. And and being able to see that working for an organization is really just a personal relationship taken to, you know, a higher level. And so that's kind of what I learned. I learned that relationships are the basis for business, and that if we are a servant leader in business, we can positively affect not only our customers and clients, but we can affect the people that work with us. And that became really a goal of mine. Like, how could I, in this very legalistic, you know, labor protected, very rule centric, very quasi military company, how could I positively affect the people that worked with me and, you know, in my organization? And so that's what I tried to do. And again, you know, it goes back to these women that really gave me my worldview.
So leadership is a big part of our organization. It's one of those core elements of that, like, hey, we're committed to developing people, giving people chances to our own growth. Really, it's one of those things that I love about us. And it's one of the interesting things that when I'm talking to people outside of Common Purpose who are asking us what are our primary measures of impact, it's really interesting. The measures that they're usually looking for when they ask that question is, how many doors have you knocked? People have you, phone calls have you made? Candidates have you supported? Volunteers do you have? Money raised? Staff size? And I will say those kinds of things. I will provide evidence on all that. But I will also talk about leadership development. It is almost always one of two responses. One response of, that is the greatest thing they can even think of. They're like, that is, man, that gets to the crux of who they are as people who are interested in organizations and life development. And they are just thrilled and love it. And we can talk for a long time about it. Or there is another response, which is a complete blank stare and a confusion. And it's very abstract to them. And we just kind of don't go anywhere with it. It's just put out there as kind of like, well, that's nice for you all. That's kind of the way they feel about it. And so I appreciate the thought about leadership that you're articulating here. Like, it is not an abstract phenomenon to you. I am certain, just from the very small amount you said here, that you have given it a lot of thought. So I want to go back to the question then, to good leadership does or good leadership is. And you said servant leadership. And I think that's one of the unifying characteristics among this organization, is that the leadership in this organization has kind of that perspective of trying to support others, help them to grow. Certainly we push each other, but that we're there to support each other. But could you get really concrete in with like a characteristic, like one characteristic like that would mean for you in a day-to-day operations, either from your time as a leader or your time being led by others who you respected?
Concrete. So what came to mind was I learned the value of listening and turning what I heard into reflection and then finally to action. And I think it's something that was very attractive to me in Common Purpose from the very beginning. And that was the first workshops back in 2018. Before teams traveled, we sort of had, and correct me if I'm wrong, but my belief system was we sort of had this structure that said you must attend a certain number of workshops to prepare interact, right? And within those workshops was a tremendous amount of listening and learning. And that listening and learning then became real action in supporting young people who were identified as our leaders. And so everything about that connected with what my career path taught me, and also connected with what I believed, like at my core, was who I wanted to be, who I was, and challenged me to be more of it and to be better at it. So that would be my concrete, you know, leadership hint, I guess, is just to really value and spend time listening and then reflecting on what you heard and then taking action on it.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks. I have had a mentor in my life, a person who was part of the civil rights movement that you have heard AJ or I mention at different times, Dr. Bernard Lafayette. And he was part of the inner circle of Dr. Martin Luther King's group. And Lafayette went to American Baptist College was a roommate with John Lewis in the 1950s. Dr. Lafayette was a very behind-the-scenes individual. He was an organizer, never famous, not written into the history books. He was the key organizer in Selma that led to the 1965 marches. But yet he's not even in the Selma movie. Okay, he's so behind the scenes. But he has a phrase. He said, we have to listen so intently as to be changed. That was the kind of model of his work, that you need to ask questions and then listen so intently as to be changed. And that is just profound. And it's always been something that stuck with me. That is my goal in listening, to be changed. And when you start from that position, you adopt a posture of intense listening and a posture of, I have something to get that is of value to how I can be a human being from what I'm about to hear. No matter what it is, there's something about this thing I'm going to hear that is important for me. Okay, so let's jump forward a little bit, or along this, and get to when you show up for Common Purpose, and what was in your life, or what were the dimensions of your life that made it a fit for you when you first got involved with us. So we'll go back to we launched in 2018, and you come and you're part of it and you get connected. So there was some dimensions to it that were attractive to you, but there were also probably some things in your life that the timing was there, made it right for you. So can you just tell us a little bit about that, like, process? Like, it's like the beginning of a relationship. Like, what was the story about how you met and why you two, you and CP, got attracted to each other?
Well, you know, it's kind of again, like all of life, right? It's this intersection, this tapestry. So when I was in high school, I had another woman in my life, another teacher, Erlene Christensen. She was my honors English teacher. She recognized me in a couple of things. She recognized I didn't necessarily fit in sort of with the social group of high school, which wasn't surprising because I really didn't ever fit in with my contemporaries. I always fit in with older, primarily women who were contemporaries of my mother, but very different. And so she became another mentor. And the reason she was so important in my connection with Common Purpose is she was part of the young white group of students primarily. She was just out of college, had just started her teaching career, who went to the South and was part of the early civil rights movement. And that informed everything about her as she taught in this very privileged high school in Chula Vista, California. She later went on to not only teach honors English, but she started the first humanities class in our school district, and really believed that she had to elevate high school students out of sort of like, who's going to invite me to homecoming, to let's talk about humanities. Let's learn, you know, these deep lessons. And I was writing the yearbook as a senior, and she invited me to come to her free period every fourth period and do my writing in her classroom because she would eat her lunch. And she started sharing with me a lot of personal connections with the civil rights movement and with personal freedoms. And so I graduated high school in 1969. So you can kind of, you know, take that back to what was going on in those years. So I sat in her classroom and watched as our beloved leaders were assassinated. And she was really the only adult that I could really mourn with, because she had the emotional connection. And my very first campaign that I ever worked on, I was still a teenager, but I worked on the Robert Kennedy campaign. Mm-hmm. And, you know, back then, working on a campaign as a minor basically meant that you shuffled paper in some big, you know, office somewhere. But I was so excited, and she was excited. And, you know, it was just sort of this culmination of all kinds of things. And going through not only the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. with her, and then Bobby Kennedy, and it just really formed this core of who I was. And so through the years, I had done some activism work, but what really pulled me into Common Purpose is the intersection with my family. So all of my children are biracial, and what I heard in Common Purpose was this organizational pull to not only help marginalized, vulnerable populations that I identified with as, oh, I have a connection with them through my children, but also pulled me in the direction of, this is an organization that would lift up my children. If my children wanted to be lifted up in this arena, Common Purpose would lift them up. So that was very attractive to me.
Okay. So, what was your first then action with us? What was the first non-workshop, go into the field or make phone calls with us?
My first was the trip to Florida. Oh, well, no, I guess that wouldn't be true. My first was we did phone bankings with Jamie Lynn Wheeler. Jamie Lynn Wheeler came on and started doing phone banking for local candidates. So I did phone banking. I think what we used to go to like Green Light Hall or something. So we did communal phone banks. So that was one of my first things. And then I went and worked for Lisa Brown over in Spokane.
Okay. Okay.
And kind of got a feel for what it was like to do the common purpose kind of work, right? Which is our boots, their ground. Had a great experience with the Lisa Brown campaign over there. Learned a lot about a part of a geographic, but also emotional and mental part of Washington that I was not familiar with because I'm not a native Washingtonian. So I didn't really know about the great difference between Eastern and Western Washington. So I got to experience that and learn from it. And then I guess my next big thing was I went to Florida with the Florida team under Amy Summers' lead.
And that was in 2018?
I believe that I went in 2019. I wasn't wave one. I was wave two.
Okay. Okay. And so ultimately... one last dimension I want to ask you about before we go to talking about your work with the organization. This is not even going to remotely do justice to your interests in this area, but I know that you have been long committed and engaged around gun violence and gun safety in the United States or perhaps globally. And so you're also very involved with another organization, Grandmothers Against Gun Violence. So could you tell us a bit about that? And I apologize that this is not going to remotely do justice to that work. But I do want to ask you about it because I want to share it with some of our podcast listeners because they might be interested in it too.
Oh, thank you so much. So Grandmothers Against Gun Violence, yes, it is. Since I've been in Washington, I had my deepest dive into civic engagement has been with Grandmothers Against Gun Violence. It is I just can't even explain what an outstanding organization it is. And you have many members within Common Purpose who are grandmothers. I actually was brought to Common Purpose by a grandmother, Donna Stringer, someone that you know very well, through just sort of a very casual conversation. We were at an event where we got to meet and hear Cory Booker. And I said to Donna, gosh, I haven't seen you. And she said, oh, well, I've been. And she started talking about Common Purpose. And I was like, what? What is this? And said, I want to know more. I learned more. And I came in. So the blame for me being part of Common Purpose lays directly at the feet of Donna Stringer. Donna Stringer also happens to be a board member for Grandmothers Against Gun Violence. Grandmothers Against Gun Violence began with four friends who met directly after Sandy Hook and said in despair, okay, this is it. You know, we have reached the bottom. What the heck do we do? And I've been involved with gun violence my entire life. Our family suffered from gun violence. My aunt was murdered through gun violence. It, again, was a life-changing moment. It changed everything about my mom. So I had worked with the Brady campaign. There was a march. I never quite get the year right. I think it was either 2000 or 2001. It was called the Million Mom March. It was a march of exactly what it said, a million moms on the National Mall in favor of sensible gun laws. And I took my three girls back to Washington, D.C., and it was a phenomenal experience for them and me. And And then the Brady campaign was sort of, you know, kind of joined in with other national campaigns, and it went on and on and on. So when I was in Washington and I heard about Grandmothers Against Gun Violence, it was just a great fit. They do tremendous work in two areas. The first and primary role is they are a organization that means to change legislation in Washington so that we have safer communities and safer schools through sensible gun legislation. We've been extremely effective. We've had 6 lobby days that are, you know, very meaningful. We did a postcard event, and we had over 3,000 postcards. So we just do a lot of work on the legislative side, and we fund research. And that's something that is, as you know, is extremely lacking in preventing gun violence, because about 2 decades ago, the United States government at a federal level decided that the CDC would not be funded to do the in-depth research work to get to the bottom of what this, you know, we've had a pandemic of gun violence in the United States that extends for decades.
Yeah.
There actually was a powerful op-ed in the New York Times 2 days ago that said that we already have a path forward that shows us how Americans will become numb to pandemic deaths, because we've become numb to the amount of people that perish due to gun violence.
Yeah.
So Grandmothers is all about how do we change that? And the women that I've had the privilege of knowing at Grandmothers Against Gun Violence, they are some of the finest women I've ever known in my life. And they bring this incredible background. Like every time I get a chance to listen to one of them and they tell me their story, I'm just like, what? Who are you? What did you do in your life? Just amazing, amazing women and fierce.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Do not let my grandmother's status fool you. I'm a grandmother, and I'm a grandmother with muscle. I will do the work. I will show up. So we actually, our motto is sort of like show up, stand up, speak out.
Okay. Wow, that's great. The way you just described hearing other people share about their stories and you saying, what? Really? Wow. I'm not surprised, but I didn't know that. That's what I hear you saying. That's how I feel about you, Bert. Right. I mean, all the time. But in this interview, in this conversation, that's part of the reason why I love doing these. There are so many things that I've not been stunned to hear, but I just didn't know.
Yeah, these conversations are just wonderful. I of all of them, you know, if I had to sort of like categorize which of the podcasts I really like, I love these because I've learned so much about particularly the young emerging leaders that we have that on really bad days gives me so much hope. I love the podcast with candidates. The one that you just did with the Alaska, I think is it Alicia? Did I get the name right?
Elise
and Emily Carmichael and Maria Abando was fantastic. And then I like the 3 things that you and Charles do because you always make me laugh.
Thanks, Bert. Thanks. Okay, I want to talk about 2 things in common purpose that you're part of. And there is perhaps no quote unquote community member who is more involved in the actual daily operations of common purpose than you. And that's in that kind of point that I just made is actually part of our logic with CP that is really, really important for our organization, for our philosophy of leadership development, to allow our folks, all of us, myself included, but particularly others, to build this organization and to figure things out, to give us space to decide and assess and evaluate and reverse course and then go around a corner this way, and to do that on our own with the support of older really wise, accomplished professionals who, without a doubt, have a whom we know have a tremendous amount of leadership and ability to kind of guide us through things. But it's important that they stay, the volunteers stay kind of outside of the circle and allow the team to develop. That's part of what's essential for leadership development, and it's part of what's essential for creating a generation of next generation diverse leaders. You know, given the fact that our population, our volunteer population for Common Purpose is mostly white, it's important to keep a boundary around the internal group, and that's part of the job I have. But you're one of the folks who we have brought in because of your profound respect and ability to navigate in that space, personally and professionally. So I want to ask you about, this is not going to be the most exciting thing for some people on the podcast, but and you know where I'm going to go now. I want to talk about it because
I do.
Because it's so important for who we are and our integrity as an organization. So we file a monthly Federal Election Commission report that goes public that everybody can see. And you are the primary person for executing on this. And then I work with you on it. Can you speak for a moment about why that work is so important for us as an organization to do that?
Well, first of all, I have to tell your audience that inspiring young leaders gets you really excited. But the truth of the matter is that the numbers on the FEC report, it just takes you right to the moon. It is something that absolutely delights me, because this is not a task for you. You actually like to dig in here. So what the FEC report, the importance I think that the FEC report holds for our organization is that it allows not only those in power to understand how we conduct ourselves, but it allows our donors, our volunteers, anybody really who's interested in the work that we do, it allows a level of transparency in which they can see how we operate in the world and how we operate on our values. So through the FEC report, we track where do we travel as a team? Where do we invest our time and our treasure? How do we caretake the precious dollars that our donors trust us with? Because I think if you go back into what role can I play? So I am not ever going to be a rising young leader in Common Purpose for some very obvious reasons. You know, when we meet, whether we meet on Zoom or we meet in person, I am always within the leadership team the oldest person in the room. I am probably the whitest person in the room, you know, being German, Irish background, right? And so I bring all of that. So it really calls on me to ask myself, what can I bring? You know, what can I offer? I mean, when you and the leadership council, which I think back then was you, Charles, AJ, and Maria, when you when you first came to me and asked me to come on board, I was like, well, I don't know what I can do. And I had no idea that it would lead to the FEC report, because originally it was just sort of administrative support. And that administrative ask really came from a miscommunication about what I did in my career, because the title, my last title, had the words network operations in it. And so in today's world, network operations means something different than what it meant in phone company world, right? So when I came in, I didn't realize that you would ask of me to take over the FEC report. So the FEC report is our ability to be completely transparent, completely honest, and to act as a conduit for our donors to understand what their precious dollars do as we engage civically and as we raise up young leaders. And so helping you keep good track of that is what I do, right? So it's all about making sure the numbers add up, they're in the right places. We have a complex sort of business model, if you will. And monthly we report to the federal government and to our donors, to our volunteers, exactly how Common Purpose operates in the world and why we're such a unique and wonderful organization.
Yeah, at the University of Washington, where I've been for a long time, we have a budgeting term that might be one that's familiar to you, that every 2 years, which is the biennium, a biennium is every 2 years, the state budget cycle runs on bienniums every 2 years. Money is allocated, and then the money has to be used or returned to the state at the end of 2 years. And so every 2 years, there's what's called a true up process, a true up where everything that you have done in your accounting over time and your expenses gets measured against a very concrete, thorough assessment of your expenditures and the budgets and the tracking, what's called reconciliation in there. And so you have to true up, and it's like a month and a half long process of making sure everything that you said is actually correct. You go all the way back through all those 2 years. Well, we true up every month for the Political Action Committee that is Common Purpose. We also true up for the 501c3 dollars that are that we run through our Fuse Washington partner. So every single month, we have a very specific sense of where we are, what we've raised, what we've spent, how we've spent it. And so on the first hand, like, I love that about our organization. I am never more than a month out, never more, of knowing exactly where we are. And that is so vital for our ability to lead and to plan. But then second, there is this dimension that we not only true up to ourselves, we true up for everybody who wants to see it. You can go look on FEC.gov and do a search for Common Purpose Fund, and you will find us. And there will be our monthly FEC reports. So both of those things so appeal to me. And they were not things that I planned when we started Common Purpose. They weren't like, oh, I want to have these as part of the organization. But then they very quickly resonated with me, that process. And it requires you, especially, and me every month going through that process. But the integrity with which I'm able to speak, or we're able to speak, to supporters and to donors about our work is priceless. It is unbelievably valuable. And as you said, you and I like it. Okay. So, there is this pleasure at getting things perfectly nailed down, right?
Yeah. You and I have talked about this, generationally, it speaks to people of my age, right? My kids cannot believe that I actually still tally a check register. They're like, what? Why would you do that? And of course, my response is, and tell me why you wouldn't. Like, how do you know the state of your finances? How do you know what your future hopes and dreams can be if you don't know to the penny what you have available to you? And, a lot of that, and I completely own this, comes from living in a family that we were lower middle class, and really holding on to that bottom rung. And so you had to account for everything. I mean, there was accounting for your pennies was extremely important, and creating some sort of self wealth, if you were, became very important to me even as a small kid. My brother and I used to go with our little wagon, and we would pick up glass Coke bottles that people would, back then people littered all the time. So you found stuff on the streets, and we would take them up to the market, and we would get money. And then, it would be we would divvy up our money. And I used to have money, like my own money, which was extremely important to me. And I always knew exactly how much money I had. So if anybody pilfered my money, I knew that I was missing something. So I've always been, it's just my nature. So when we do the FEC report, for me, it's just like, oh, this is just a bigger, more robust check register. And down to the penny we go. And I'm lucky that I work with someone who, number one, is as forgiving as you are, and number two, as supportive as you are. Because one might imagine that as Common Purpose has grown, the FEC report has grown considerably. And and to your point, not only do we have the PAC, we have the super PAC, we have this intersection of money. Money has to be reported appropriately to the federal government. And I've learned a lot. I knew nothing about it when you asked me to start interacting with it. I've learned a lot more than I probably ever hoped to. But at the same time, it appeals to certain parts of my personality. And it also makes me feel as if there is a concrete, to use your term, way that I can support the young rising leaders of Common Purpose, but by ensuring that we're a solvent organization, that that we have the monies and the means to support their growth. And the FEC report is the way that we lay that out for donors. You know, I used to have to give expert testimony, or I was asked to give expert testimony on behalf of the phone company in California to the Public Utilities Commissions. And we did the same thing that you're talking about at the University of Washington. We would true up budgets. We would have to explain why we, you know, closed down certain projects and funded other projects and how that affected certain communities, rural, you know, urban, all those kinds of things. And people care about how you spend your money, especially if you're a public, if you're a public utility. Oh, people want to know. You know, like, you did what? You had a conference where? You sent how many people to what kind of school? You know, those kinds of questions. And so I learned to appreciate that if you were going to be an organization by which either a state, Washington or California, funded you in part, or donors, you best better be as honest and transparent as possible.
Yep. I cannot communicate effectively enough how profoundly meaningful it is to know exactly all of the dollars, where they are at all of the times, and then to publicly report it. How that is so fulfilling, and also gives me such confidence to ask for support. Like, there is a daily reconciliation process that we go through. One last question on this. We have our pal, we have a special friend at the FEC who gives us counsel and guidance, and his name is Kevin, and Kevin has been tremendous over time. Over 2 years, we've gotten to know him, and he's been there the whole time, and what a gift it is to us that it's been Kevin the whole time. He gives us, he's like the helpline person. You've talked to Kevin a number of times. What is the FEC's impression of how we do in our processing and filing of reports? What is Kevin's kind of a professional assessment of our level of care and concern?
Oh, Kevin's delightful. As you said, he's also extremely professional and keeps within the bounds of what you would expect any federal government agent would. But in our conversations, he has done nothing but praise a Common Purpose. He talks constantly about the diligence that we spend. He has told me on several occasions, you know, it's sort of our growth is kind of, you know, astronomical, if you will. At one time I was talking to him, and I think I used the phrase sort of like, well, you know, we're sort of like this small grassroots, and he stopped me and he goes like, you're not small. And I wouldn't call you grassroots anymore. He said, you're really a significant organization, and I appreciate that you take this report so seriously. Hmm. Right? And of course, the reason he knows we take it so seriously is because I call him so often. And he's great because he's like the keeper of all the hacks for the FEC report. Like, he can give me one hint that cuts hours of my process off because he goes, oh, I don't, you know, the FEC report, as one might imagine, is just, I mean, you can get lost in the weeds of it, right? And he is so great in saying, like, oh, those 15 questions right there in sort of the middle of that page, you don't need to answer those because they don't roll up. I don't see them. Those are only internal, right? And I'm like, what? And he goes, yeah, you don't need to do that. Here's what you need to do. Or you don't need to make this separate memo page. If you want, you can just go on this one line and you can put these words in and that will flag me. So he's just like this incredible, again, he's a federal government official who really acts like our servant. He goes like, how can I help you do this report in an easier, better way? And he's so patient because number one, I don't know the language. Number two, I have no training. I'm not an accountant. I'm not a bookkeeper. I've never done this work before. And he will listen to me. He will respond to me. And he will ask questions so that he gets more about, like, really, Bert, what is it that you're asking me? And he's been phenomenal. And he has been so... he seems to be grateful that through your direct leadership, Common Purpose values and takes the FEC report seriously. Because I think you, when this began as the treasurer of Common Purpose, you had the ability to determine, would we do quarterly reports or monthly reports? And you said, no, we're going to do monthly reports because I think that serves us and our donors better. Did I get that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. So we could be an organization that sort of just did this quarterly and, you know, all of that, but we do it monthly at your direction. And I think Kevin appreciates that because, as you know, it really does get down to where you dot the I and where you cross the T. It's a pretty, it's a forgiving online app, but it also is an online app that requires you be down to the zip code of where all of our donors live. And that's the other thing that I want to say about the FEC report. What I really appreciate about it is that it gives me hope. You know, most people, when you think of financial reports, don't think of them as sort of vehicles for hope. But when I look at the number of donors that support our work, from small monthly donors of $10 a month given over month to these huge checks that I can't even conceive of being able to write, it just gives me so much hope. It talks about how Common Purpose speaks to people who want to move this democracy towards a more just and inclusive space. And I think I wish if anybody was going to read the FEC report, you know, take a look at where we spend our money, but really take a look at who gives us money.
It's
isn't it profoundly moving to you? It has to be.
It is. It is completely so. And I don't know if people who are listening to this episode feel that same way in hearing it as I'm feeling in talking about the FEC report. Probably not. But it is a story, a lens into our organization that is remarkable, that is compelling, that is inspiring. And I think about it from the lens of a researcher. As somebody at the University of Washington, or over the course of my graduate school and professional work, I try to understand things about the world, and I go to certain places for data, certain pieces of evidence. And sometimes that evidence is words, the things that people said. Sometimes it's numbers that are part of an organization or a personal set of accounting. Sometimes it's relationships that people have had and how they've handled them. And each of them is a lens onto the phenomena that I'm studying. And they tell you something really interesting. And so our FEC report and the way we approach it and the kinds of people who support us and our reporting of them and the information we get from them, we need names, we need addresses, we need occupations, all of that stuff is a lens into the care that we take, into the people who want to support this work, into the way in which people will come to and invest treasure into an organization and into a cause. It is a narrative about us that is really important. A phrase out there is that, a budget is really an articulation of an organization's values. And in this case, a budget is an articulation of our values and our care as an organization. And it is also an articulation of our volunteers and our supporters and their values and their care. So one last thing I want to bring up on this is the other side of the coin about government and about why we are so committed to leadership with integrity, leadership that cares about people, that is competent. So Kevin is a federal civil servant. Is that the right? Civil official. That he's hired by the government and is not a political position, which means he cannot be hired or fired for partisan reasons. He lasts throughout different political leadership. But when the government shut down and stopped funding employees for a couple months back in, I think it was 2019, it might have been 2018. No, it was 2019. Kevin was not employed. He was not there. He wasn't there for us. And he, we would leave messages and we'd know that he's not coming back until it started up again. And that kind of dismissal of the importance that he brings to us, but to hundreds of other organizations, is just one small drop in this massive reservoir of what civil servants do and that competent government is set up to bring. And so when we see incompetent governmental leadership, as we see with the Trump administration, and the absolute dismissal of all of these patriots who fight for this country and believe in it around intelligence, around public health, around accounting and regulations, all of that, it is profoundly angering to me, the kind of human and national dismissal that is present in that contempt. So that's that's me making a bit of a statement, but we've seen that firsthand in a human, in a specific human in Kevin.
Yeah. And, we know of the many things that the Trump administration has gutted in the United States in 2019, the end of 2018, but most of 2019, they completely gutted the FEC commission. And so for all of the workers who have this incredible caseload, I think once Kevin said he has nearly 300 organizations that he sort of shepherds. Think of that. Think of the complexity of that, right? And, there was a reason that the Trump administration wanted to gut the FEC commission. Gee, why would that be? Oh, PACs. Oh, yep. Money. Oh, okay. Let's see. What would be an organization that might hold up something that could reflect negatively, if you would? Gosh, could we even imagine that on the Trump administration? And it would be what the FEC commission is all about. And so for Kevin, he's just been someone that we have a relationship with and that we care about. And he, when the furlough was over and he came back, he actually responded to me once in a voicemail and he said, I've got this incredible backlog. I'm there for you. Just file the report. I know that you're going to, do due diligence. We'll work it out. And we have. We've worked out issues with Kevin in a really satisfactory way because I think he believes in the work that he does. I think he believes that the work he does is important to our national health. I want to honor that by giving him a product that says, yeah, we honor that. We honor that too. We believe the same thing.
Yeah. And, you know, I read a book. I try to read books with the same mindset that I mentioned about listening. I try to read books in order to be changed. So I'm careful about the books that I read. I give them a little bit of a vetting because it's an investment. And it's an investment in my time, but also in my personal set of values. And I read a book by Michael Silver recently called The Fifth Risk. And yep. It's about risks that are present in government or in life, in organizations. And the fifth risk is a term that references the risk in which there are risks you cannot plan for that can only be solved by having competent leadership in place, that you essentially address the fifth risk that could come up unplanned. You address that by having competent leadership in place. And the Trump administration, as documented in Silver's book, from the beginning, did not give a crap about so many elements of life that we see unfolding before us in disastrous ways now around the pandemic.
I think they believe their wealth elevated them, right? Their wealth could elevate them above the need for competence. And so we now, as the nation, suffer because of this errant belief that they have. And competency, where would you find that in the Trump administration? That's not fair. You know where you find it? You find it exactly in your point with Kevin, with true civil servants who believe in the Constitution and in what this country, flawed in the many ways that it is, what this country holds up as the ideal. In the Kevins of the world, of my friend Laura, who put in 32 years at the State Department and retired because she just couldn't take this administration anymore. They're the true servants. They're competent, but their competency isn't valued by the people at the top. And that's heartbreaking.
Yeah. And that's part of what our long-term job is we have an election now, and then we have enormous amount of work after that to support and elevate and to rebuild our infrastructure and our leadership in this country. So, hey, Bert, I'm going to wrap it up. I really appreciate so much you and taking this time and sharing your journey and your story with myself and with our podcast listeners. I didn't even talk with you about really going to Florida and your work there because for this one, I just wanted to talk about the FEC report in terms of your work. But you are one of our co-leads for Florida. And I know that we have some dates on the calendar that are planned for this fall to do work there. And that has been a state that you and we have been invested in, and we will continue to be invested in. So on so many fronts, Bert, I'm just grateful and appreciative of your engagement with us at Common Purpose. Thanks for taking time in this podcast, and we should get back to work.
Let's do it. Thank you. It's been a privilege and an honor. Thanks so much.
Okay, Bert. See you later.
All righty. Bye.
Bye.